Unfortunately, we have been listening to the disintegration of the whole religious Jewish communities here. But in the 1600s and the 1700s, they had very great gedolim going.
Can everybody hear in the back?
Yeah.
In the late 1600s and the early 1700s, they had very great the whole 1700s, had very great gedolim here. As we heard, most of them were Sephardim. And one of the prominent Rabbanim who was here in the late 1600s was the Chacham Tzvi. Even though he's called Chacham, and he used to sign his name, Chacham Tzvi Ashkenazi Samachtes, Samachtes is usually assumed to mean Sephardi Tahor, which means that one of two things, usually. Either means that after 1492, his ancestors did not convert. He was purely religious. They didn't convert and then become Jewish again. Or Sephardi Tahor means that they didn't intermarry with any Chalila, with any Ashkenazim. But the Chacham Tzvi was a regular Ashkenazi. So what does it mean, Samachtes? And his son, Rabbi Yankov Emden, also Yavetz, Rabbi Yankov Emden, he also signed his name. Samachtes. Obviously, it must be another meaning. We find some of the Sephardish have encyclopedias about their heritage. So there's a Rabbi Mazuz in Bnei Brak, very prominent elderly Sephardic goyim in Eretz Israel, who put out a whole encyclopedia about Sephardish topics. So he quotes that you have earlier sources, way before 1492. Where Sephardim would sign their name Samachtes, and they would only sign Samachtes after living people, not after dead people. Dead people, they write Zayin Lamed, Ayin Hey, all the Rasham, they wouldn't write Samachtes. Apparently, Samachtes means something else. Seife Tov, the end will be good, you should have a good end or something. Something like Shlita, it didn't mean Sephardi Tahor. Anyway, so the Chacham Tzvi was a real Ashkenazi. And he was rabbi in many different communities. He never lasted too long because he never got along with the Balabatim. And he's known for many of his original opinions. Some of them have been accepted and others have not at all been accepted. For example, there was always a big debate whether women are permitted to go to a warmed-up mikveh on Friday night. Halel Yontif, in the days of the Tanaim, they made a gzera that's called Gzeres HaBalonim. A balon is a bathhouse attendant. So in the days of the Tanaim, the bathhouse attendants were not the most observant people. And the practice used to be that people would go to the bathhouse on Shabbos afternoon. So the bathhouse attendant would make the fire on Shabbos afternoon, heat up the water. He knew that no one's going to come before they bench, after they have their challenge, whatever. No one's going to come before 2 o'clock. So they would heat up the water on Shabbos. So the Tanoi made a Gzera de Rabbanan. You're not allowed to bathe in warm water on Shabbos, even if it's true that the water was warmed up on Erev Shabbos. Let's say I fill up a bathtub on Erev Shabbos with burning hot water. I'm going to take a warm bath on Friday night. So in 2 hours, the water, instead of being burning hot, will be lukewarm. So you're not allowed to do that. That's a Gzera Sapalon. You're not allowed to take a warm bath. So that was always a big issue. How can women go to a warmed up mikveh? You require of the women have to go to an ice cold mikveh, Leil Shabbos. So it's famous that Balatanya, who lived later, Balatan lived in the late 1700s. Balatanya once said that he doesn't know if he's going to go to Olam Haba, to Gan Eden. If he goes to Gan Eden, it'll be for 3 things that he did. One, none of them was for writing the Tanya. One was for writing the Shulchan Aruch Harav. I forgot the second. And the third was for his kula, that the married women are permitted to go to a warmed up mikveh. So he gives a whole explanation why it's mutter. I think the generally accepted explanation why we assume it's mutter is because Gzeres HaBalonim is only if you're going to bathe in a shower, a bathe in a bath. A bathe means you're going to singing in the shower. You're going to take a shower for 10 minutes. but the people going to the mikveh, they just dip in and they get out and shine. Half a minute, the whole thing. So that's not called rechitza b'chamet. Rechitza b'chamet means you stay there for a while. That's usually assumed to be the reason for the hetter. That's what Avdei Nezer writes. So the Chacham Tzvi is known. He said that it's also. He paskin that it's also for the women to go to a warm mikveh. They have to go to a nice cold mikveh. That opinion was not accepted. Then Chacham Tzvi is famous also. In his opinion, the Gemara tells us that if you have wine barrels, wine containers that had wine that was processed by non-Jews, that's called stam yenam. If the Nochri pours the wine in front of Avodah Zarah, that's a biblical prohibition. Yain Nesach, yain that was misnasach Avodah Zarah, that's an Issa Deraisa. But stam yenam means wine that the non-Jews processed. So that's forbidden by the Rabbonim because it may lead to intermarriage. Then they threw in another concern, maybe he was menasach. That's a far-fetched chashash. The non-Jew was menasach it for Avodah Zarah. How's he going to give it to somebody to drink? He designated it for his Avodah Zarah. So because they wanted to prohibit, like Bishalakum and Pasakum, they wanted to prohibit Stam Yena because it may lead to intermarriage, that was a real concern. So they threw in also this added chashash. Maybe the Nochri was menasach in Avodah Zarah. So not only will the Stam Yenam wine be also b'shtiya, like Pasakim and Bishlakim is also b'achina, but it's mutar b'anan. But the Stam Yenam, they asked it even b'anan because of the additional chashash. Okay. So because it's only a din der Rabbanan, so they made a kula that if you have a barrel that contains Stam Yenam, and it was empty, so you have to, then you want to put in kosher wine, so you have to kasher the barrel. The Mishnais tell you how to kasher barrels with agola, fine. So the Tanoim had a kula, if the barrel has been empty for 12 months, it wasn't used for any tray for wine, then there's no need to kasher it. Chalal Chacham Tzvi came up with the kula that again has not been accepted. That not only does this kula, this leniency apply the barrels that contain Stam Yenam, even a pot that you cook the Chazer Shmaltz in. If nobody used it for 12 months for Dreyfus, they used it for kosher. But nobody used it for 12 months for Dreyfus, so whatever blia there may possibly be in the walls of the pot have already evaporated and disappeared, and there's nothing to talk about, and there's no need to kosher the pot. So then again, that opinion of the Chacham Tzvi has not really been accepted. Then it's famous also in the yeshivas. This in the yeshivas, they know this. Chatz Yishir is, we assume, is also menator. Let's say you're going to buy cakes or cookies from a non-kosher bakery. What can already be non-kosher about the cake or the cookie? What has, so the maximum it can have has a little chazer shmaltz in it, has a little dreifus in it. But it's only less than a kazayis. You're eating less than a kazayis. So that's why we say a chatz yishir is also menator. So the Chacham Tzvi came up with a chiddush that also has not been accepted. A lot of his chiddushim have not been accepted. He was a very original thinker. So he came up with a chiddush that chatz yishir is also menator only applies to midi d'achila, only when it comes to eating food. As far as Malach HaShabbos, as far as other areas of Halacha, where there's a shir, then there is no din of chatz yishir as menator. So the Mishlam Melech, in his commentary on the Rambam, quotes this from the Chacham Tzvi. And in the footnotes on the Mishlam Melech, in parentheses, always has Aleph Hey, Omer HaMagia. The author of the... What's the name of the Sefer that he wrote on Chumash? I forgot. Rav Yankiv Kili. I forgot the Sefer of Chumash. So he writes in the Haggadah on the Mishlam Melech, he shows that Rashi said the Beferish against this Chacham Tzvi. Chacham Tzvi was involved. What he has to say about Eruvin was very fundamental. That what he said has been accepted. He was involved in making the Eruv in The Hague. And he explained that since you have the moat, you have a crack in the ground that's 10 Tvachim deep and it's 4 Tvachim wide. So that, and then it goes up again. So that constitutes a mechitza. So even though there's no mechitza above the ground, the mechitza below the ground level also constitutes a mechitza. So that's quoted by the commentaries of Shulchan Aruch. That is accepted. And then he pointed out that there were those who thought that all of England, because it's an island, has the status of Rosh Hashayachid, because the edge of the island goes in. When you have a beach, that's not called a mechitza, but if you have what they call the continental shelf, and it goes straight down, that is considered a mechitza. And even though the mechitza is below the water, so that's also considered a good mechitza minatur. So the Chachman Tzvi explains, based on the Gemara, it's not true. That's beferish, not correct. But he was involved in making a Reuven in England. He traveled around a lot.
You're not talking to the mic when you're demonstrating the
mechitzas
with your arm.
Yeah. So the Chacham Tzvi pointed out that there are different kinds of mechitzas. Some mechitzas are above the ground. Some mechitzas are below the ground level. And you can be mitzarev two mechitzas like this and two mechitzas like that. He never really proved it conclusively. All the proofs that he gives are really from cases where you have three mechitzas of one type, fourth is of the other type. And the whole need for the fourth mechitza is only with the Rabbanim, so it doesn't really prove that two and two is good. But that has been accepted from the Chacham Tzvi. The commentaries on the side of the page in the Shulchan Aruch quoted, and it has been accepted. There was a period of time when the Chacham Tzvi, he traveled around a lot. The Chacham Tzvi lived in Hamburg. So when he lived in Hamburg, he used to have a yeshiva there. He had a very outstanding, sharp talmidim. So the practice in Hamburg used to be an incorrect practice. Instead of having, when you have an Erev, so you make a mechitza around the area, and then you have to collect the chalas from all the Shomer Shabbos. You have to pitch in. Everybody, every family has to give a chal. You have to put all the chalas in one container. You put a box of matzahs, all the matzahs in one container. You never have to have more than 18 gregris. That's six kibbutzim of challah, but it has to be owned b'shutfus by all of the Shomer Shabbos. So in Hamburg, the practice was, when he was there, which is improper, that they had one little matzah in each of the shuls. And no one matzah had the shear of 18 gregris in it. Didn't know one matzah had six kibbutzim of flour in it. So he put an end to that. He said that that's not correct. All of the matzahs that are owned b'shutfas by all of the Shomer Shabbos have to all be in one container. Unless you have, let's say, two boxes of matzah, one box is full, there's no room for more matzahs. Then you have the overflow, you put in another box of matzahs. Or you put all the challahs that you collected from all the Shomer Shabbos in one bag, and then the bag is full, so then you can put the overflow, the rest, put in another bag, and so on. So he put an end to that practice, and that is correct. That wasn't an original Kiddush of his. Just pointed out that that's the din. See what he said about The Hague and what he said about England, that wasn't the original Kiddush. He just pointed it out, and everybody accepted it. That's what it says in the Gemara. He did point out one thing was a Kiddush. He says, Rav Yosef Karo always quotes the Rashbo. The Rashbo wrote a sefer called Avodas HaKodesh, has all of Hilchos Erivin in it, how to make an Eriv. And there are Beis Yosef quotes it a lot. And there's one major paragraph in the Avodas HaKodesh of the Rashbo, which Rav Yosef Karo did not quote. So the Chacham Tzvi thinks that we should accept what the Rashbo said, even though Rav Yosef Karo didn't quote it, again, has not been accepted. The Rashbo came up with a chiddush that if you have a major thoroughfare, you have a city square, we have 600,000 people roaming around there doing business and traveling in all different directions. Even if you put walls around it, it won't have the status of Rosh Hashayach. So that has not really been accepted. But nobody hold like that. That's a far-fetched case anyway. You go put walls around. A popular view of the Chacham Tzvi that people talk about today, Chacham Tzvi never lived in Eretz Yisrael. He lived in many different places. He never lived in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yosef Karo lived in Eretz Yisrael in the 1500s, and he writes that there were many pilgrims who came, tourists, who were Jewish tourists, who would come for Pesach Shavuot Sukkot to spend Yontif in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yosef Karo writes that the common practice was that the Jews who came to visit on Pesach Shavuot Sukkot, who are going to go back to Chutzlortz after the Yontif is over, always observed 2 days Yontif. And this was the common practice for centuries. Rabbi Eskar lived in the 1500s. And Chacham Tzvi never lived in Eretz Yisrael. He writes it doesn't make sense to him. He thinks that he only observed 1 day in Eretz Yisrael. Today that's becoming more and more popular. The question is that because it's easier? Life is easier like that.
Yep. You
can do business. Yeah. But so that's Rav Kook is famous. Rav Kook felt that also like the Chacham Tzvi, they should only observe 1 day Yom Tov. So they have in their biographies of Rav Kook that once there used to be in the 1920s, 1930s, a significant number of Jews would come from Europe to spend Pesach, to spend Yom Tov in Eretz Yisrael. So one of the hotel owners came to Rav Kook and he asked if he'll give him a hechsher for his hotel, because Rav Kook was the chief rabbi at that time. So Rav Kook asked, do you plan to make one Seder or two Sederim? So he said, no, two Sederim. We're going to have 2 days Yom Tov. Because all the people coming from Germany, the Frum and Balabatim, want to have 2 days Yom Tov. So Rav Kook held that it's not correct. And he says, I can't give a hechsher. Goodbye. So the fellow was very concerned. The Balabatim are going to come, they're going to find that he has no hechsher. He was a Shem Shabbos, but they're not going to rely on him. They'll want to have some prominent rabbi who'll give a hechsher. So he didn't know what to do. What's he going to do? The Balabatim are going to come. He doesn't have a hechsher with the chief rabbi. So one of his business associates told him, go to one of the married Talmidim who learns in Merkaz Rav Kook and Rav Kook's yeshiva and offer him a significant amount of money. He should be the mashgiach. And the fellow will certainly agree because he could use a few dollars. And then after he agrees, then ask him if he can speak to the Rosh Yeshiva, to Rav Kook, that he should endorse the Hashgacha. So Rav Kook, they thought, Rav Kook is not going to tell him not to take the job, to be mafsid one of the young men at Parnassa. So that's what he did. He went to one of the young married men, one of the Avrechim in American Sarav, and the fellow agreed. Then he said, could you speak to the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Kook, that he should endorse him? So he went to Rav Kook. He didn't realize that the Balabas had already gone to Rav Kook. So Rav Kook realized what the fellow did. Wise guy. So he said he'll only give his endorsement to the Hashgacha because he knows they're going to have Yom Tov Sheni. Only do it if they have an orchestra playing music during the meal on the second night of Pesach. So that's what they had. So the Balabatim were making Kiddush and Seder and they had an orchestra playing music at the same time. So that's that opinion of the Chacham Tzvi is becoming more prominent today. But for many centuries, it was not at all the accepted opinion. Chacham Tzvi is the one who has the funny shaila. Can you be mitzar for goylem to a minyan? If you have 9 Jewish people, and the 10th person was a goylem, a human being who was created by somebody who knows Kabbalah. So people who don't look in the Chacham Tzvi think that he's talking about the Marambi Prague with the goylem. He's not talking about the Marambi Prague. He writes that he had a grandfather who was known as the Baal Shem of Chelem. Chelem was a real city. And the story, the family tradition had it that his grandfather created a goylem and he functioned for a while and then the grandfather had to kill him because he was making too much trouble. So he has this suffix, how can he be mitzar for goylem to a minyan? He's not Jewish. He's not a Jewish person. The Chazon Ish writes, he's not a human being at all. A goylem, in order to be Jewish, you have to be a human being. If the grandfather killed the goylem, and they say the Marambi Prague also, he killed his goylem, how can he kill the Gemara tells a story. Rava Barigav, Rava made a goylem, and so the goylem was not able to carry on a conversation. He couldn't talk, so he killed the goylem. If the goylem would have the status of a human being, so you're not allowed to kill a human being. So obviously it's like a behemoth. So you can't be Jewish, you can't be mitzar from to a minyan if he's not a human being. Why did the Chacham Tzvi even have a half a minute to think that you can be mitzareh for goylem to a minyan? So he says, because the Gemara has a statement that kol ha-megadol ben chavero, kol ha-megadol yosem etoch pesa, kol ha-megadol ben chavero, ma'ala olav ha-kosu ki'ilu yelodo. Let's say if people are not able to have natural children, so they should adopt. And when you adopt a child and you raise the child, it's considered a partial fulfillment of the mitzvah period of Eridium. So since a megadol ben chavera malal akasav malam etara ben chavera malal akasav kili yelado, So since a Jewish person created the Golem, maybe that's like Ilui Yelodin. Yeah, but what do you mean? If you adopt a non-Jewish child, you don't have to convert them. Of course you have to convert them. So that suffix, even though it's quoted by the commentaries in the Shulchan Aruch, that's absolutely not accepted at all. Among the various travels of the Chacham Tzvi, he lost his position every time he got involved in the Machlokes. So he spent a few years in Amsterdam. Bill Balabatim couldn't take it anymore, so he had to leave Amsterdam also. So when he came to Amsterdam, he was confronted with a new thing that he never saw before, democracy. He never saw democracy before. So the din is, if you have an Erev around the community, so that's the Mechitza. When you have the poles with the string on top, that's the Tzuras HaPesach, the frame of a door. And the frame of the door is considered the Mechitza. But then there's a Takana Shlema HaMelech, that you're not allowed to carry from one house to the other, even though they're all Rishon Sayach. Let's say there's an apartment building. But the whole building is one gigantic Rishon Sayach. But since one family lives in one apartment, different family lives in another apartment, so you're not allowed to carry from one apartment to the other, from one apartment into the hallway. You're not allowed to carry from the hallway into the apartments unless you put away your box of matzahs. They put away the box of matzahs, the chalas and so on. Each of the Shemir Shabbos have to own a share in the shutfis to the extent you have to have a maximum of 18 grogers. Fine. You have more than 18 families, you don't need more than 18 grogers. Just all the families should have a shutfis in that box of matzahs. But what do you do with the non-Jews who live there? The non-Jews, the whole issue of the Erev is not relevant for them. They're going to carry with or without an Erev. Or you have people who don't observe Shabbos, they're going to carry with or without an Erev. So the whole box of matzahs is irrelevant with respect to the non-Jews or with respect to the Jews who are not at all Shomer Shabbos. They don't observe Shabbos at all. So you have to rent from them their apartment. So let's say you have a big city. You have Sarajevo. You have a big city. So you have to go rent from every Nochri, the Jewish part of the population. It was nowhere near 100% of the population. It was a small percentage of the population. So on the Shulchan Aruch, they quote from the Rivosh, if you rent from the Moshel Ha'ir has a right to represent all of the non-Jews and all of the Mechalei Shabbos who live in the city. So the Moshel Ha'ir was the king who has a right to declare war and station soldiers in everyone's home during wartime. When he came to Amsterdam, he was confronted with democracy. There is no king who has the right to declare war. And he can't just station troops. If there's a war going on, if the Congress approves the war, so then the king has a right for the purposes of waging the war to station soldiers in your apartment. But he has no right to declare the war. So the Chacham Tzvi writes in the Sefer that if you live in a democracy, you can't make an Erev. Because what are you going to go rent from every single Nachri? It'll take you forever. And there is no Moshel Ha'ir. So we don't follow that opinion of the Chacham Tzvi. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writes in his Sefer, he doesn't even quote the Chacham Tzvi. The commentary is on the side of the page, and the big Shulchan Aruch quote the Chacham Tzvi. Moshe Feinstein doesn't want to be insulting to the Chacham Tzvi. So he just explains why it is good. He doesn't say that the Chacham Tzvi says it's no good. He just says, since the mayor was appointed, the mayor was elected by the citizens of the city, so the mayor can certainly represent all of the people in the city. There's a famous sheet of the Chacham Tzvi that he got into trouble for. He was always very insistent in his opinions. There was a period of time that he was in Hamburg. He and another rabbi alternated. He was officially the rabbi 6 months of the year, and the other one was officially the rabbi the other 6 months of the year. So there was a shaila, they shechted a chicken. So you have to check the lungs, you have to check different things to make sure that there are no treifas. So they shechted an animal, and there was no heart. So if there was no heart, so she'd certainly be a treifa. So the Chacham Tzvi said, there is no such thing. An animal can't exist without a heart, scientifically, and there certainly was a heart, and they must have cut it out and hidden it, or it got lost somewhere. That's ridiculous. You can't say an animal is a treifa if you didn't find the heart. Some wise guy must have taken the heart and hid it. And the other rabbi in town said, not so. There's no heart, so it's a treifa. The Chacham Tzvi said, it doesn't exist. So they were so, the opinions were so sharp about each other, they felt that Chacham Tzvi was like an apicatus, that he's saying, he came up with a new chiddush based on science. So that's when he left the Rabbanus of Hamburg. Some of the Rabbanus, and he wasn't fired. He was never fired by the Balabatim, but he just realized that the jig was up, so he just left. Ramon Shulchan Aruch quotes a Chumrah that Kohanim are not permitted to come in Ohel HaMeis, in the same house where there's a meis, even though you're not in the same room with the meis, but if the door is open, so the tumah goes from one room to the other room to the other room, the tumah can go. And even though the door is closed, the door is totally closed between one room and the other, but if we plan to take the meis out this direction, so we consider that door, that's what we call Sof Tumah Latzeis. Since we plan to open the door later, so we consider it as if the door were open now. It's a question, is this a halacha l'moshe m'Sinai? It's a din d'oraisa, or is it a din d'rabbanan? So there are two versions in Rashi. What's the nature of this din? But on the books and the Mishnayos, there is a din that's called Sof Tumah Latzeis. So the Pashto says that this din of Sof Tumah Latzeis only applies if the mace is in the same house where the Kohen wants to go. But there's a door that's closed right now, and the Tumah cannot go through the door if it's closed. But since we plan to open the door in another 2 hours, we're going to take the mace out, so we consider it as if the door is open already now. Let's say there's going to be a funeral in the yeshiva. They're going to have a funeral in Lamport Auditorium this afternoon. They're going to bring in a mace at 1 o'clock for a funeral. So the Kohanim are permitted to sleep in the dormitory in the morning. You don't say, Sof Tumah Lahavi, we're going to bring a mace. The person died, and he's in a funeral home now, and we're going to bring the mace to the Lamport Auditorium at 12:45. But the students can stay there till they bring the mace. That's not, the only time you say, Sof Tumah Lahavi, if the tomb is in the same house, and there's a roof going from one room to the other, and you have a lot of doors that are closed, you treat it as if all the doors that are closed were open. So the Ramah quotes a Chumrah from the Trumas HaDeshen that there used to be Makpid about, that if the only way to leave, let's say someone died in the city, the only way to leave the city to go to the cemetery is to go through the Shar Ha'ir, and the Shar Ha'ir has a roof on top of it. And right now the mace is not under that roof. Mace is in a funeral home in the city. And the Shar Ha'ir is not a hempshire. The roof over the gate to the city is not contiguous to the roof over the house where the mace is now. So there's a chumra from the Trumas HaDeshen that the Kohanim shouldn't go under the Shar Ha'ir, as if it were a Sof Tumah Latzeis. So the Chacham Tzvi has a whole tshuva. He makes fun of that, and he says that the Chumrah doesn't make any sense, and you don't have to observe it. It was Yadua, the Chacham Tzvi, with his son, Rabbi Yagidem, that were not happy about the Chumrah of Kitnias. But again, the Kitnias keeps on getting stronger and stronger. The Minik, not the Kitnias by Ashkenazi, keeps on getting stronger and stronger in every generation. So his dislike for the Minik didn't help too much. Was an issue that came up in Italy. The people who followed Shabtai Tzvi, so Shabtai Tzvi, when they threatened to kill him because he claimed that he was the Melech HaMashiach, so the king said, what do you mean you're the Melech? I'm the Melech. So he pressured him to convert to Islam. And that would be, the jig would be up, that would be the end of the whole shtick. If you're a Muslim, you can't be the Jewish Melech HaMashiach. So Chacham Tzvi, to save his skin, to save his life, he converted to Islam. Then to cover up on himself, so he said, no, that's the way to hasten the coming of Mashiach. You have to go to the depths of Tumah. Everyone, all of us, he encouraged all of his followers to convert to Islam. And then we're gonna pull ourselves out, and we're gonna then it's gonna be the good time. Then it's gonna be Moshiach. So he had many of his followers. They all converted to Islam. So there was a fellow in Italy who I converted to Islam because he was a follower of Shabbat Tzvi. Then he realized the whole thing is a joke. So he was a chosev in tshuva, and he became a normal observant Jew. So he once wanted to be, probably paid money, to become the chosen Torah on Simchas Torah. So the shaila was that this, they said it's not right. Since he converted to Islam, he was a mishumid, even though now he was chosev in tshuva, how can they be mechabed him with chosen Torah? So the Chachman Tzvi writes a tshuva. He was asked, the shaila from Candia, which is near Italy. So he was asked the shaila. So he said, look, the Gemara says the last aliyah in the Torah is called Shemoneh Psukim Shabbat Torah. Eight psukim before the end of the Chumash writes about the burial of Moshe Rabbeinu, about the obituary. Vayomash Moshe Eved Hashem. So the Gemara says, that aliyah you should give yochid kari yosem. You should give that aliyah to a yochid. What does that mean? So there are different interpretations. So in Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah quotes one of the interpretations that appears in the Mordechai, one of the later Bali HaTosfos. Yochid means yochid u'miyuchad. You should give the chosen Torah to the rabbi, because the last aliyah in the Torah says Moshe Rabbeinu passed away, Yeshua ben Nun took over, and the people listen to Yeshua ben Nun like they listen to Moshe Rabbeinu. So you give that aliyah to the rabbi, that in our generation, the local Orthodox rabbi is the one who follows in the footsteps of Moshe Rabbeinu, and everyone should follow the local Orthodox rabbi like we followed Moshe Rabbeinu. So there is an opinion in Shulchan Aruch that the chasen Torah should be given davka to the rabbi of the community. But he says, in your community, if you're not following that minhag, you're auctioning it off to the highest bidder. You're going to give it to a balabas. So what's the difference whether the balabas was always a religious person? He once became a convert, he once converted to Islam, and then he became a Shema Mitzvah again. Same thing, a nice religious Jew. So you can give him chasen Torah. If you want to give to the rabbi, that's one thing, but if it's not going to be the rabbi, why should you discriminate against this balabas just because at one time he was a mishumah? So the Chachman Tzvi was a famous goyin. He had a lot of original opinions on a lot of different things. Most of them were not accepted. Most of his original chidushim were not accepted. And those that were accepted is because he just pointed out Gemaras. Wasn't really his original. He just pointed out Gemaras. Basically, his original ideas were not accepted. He lived. He didn't have the shach. He didn't have all the svarim. Taz, the shach. He didn't have all the svarim that we had. He had the taz. One of the things that he did was he published the Taz's commentary on Chosh HaMishpat anonymously. He didn't write his name. And when he adds a lot of comments to explain what the Taz is saying, so he writes Aleph Hey, Omah HaMagia. So that's of value. He published the Taz is saying. But he didn't have the Shach, he didn't have, we have the Be'er Agro, all the people who lived later. He didn't have all of those Svarim. So that's why most of his opinions are, his original opinion, not really accepted. Wanted to speak a little more about the Chacham Tzvi, because he's such a prominent Talmud Chacham, even though most...
Can everybody hear?
Even though in most of the cases we don't really follow the opinions of the Chacham Tzvi, but he was a very prominent Talmud Chacham. So I wanted to speak a little more just about his personal biography, about his life, because it's very strange why he was in so many different places. Mm-hmm. So basically... His father's name was Rabbi Yankov Zak. Zak stands for Zerah Kodesh. Apparently every person had their own last name, and his name was Tzvi Hirsch Ashkenazi. He took on a different name. He wasn't adopted. He was the son of his father Yaakov. And his son was Rabbi Yankov Emden, named after his father, Yankov Zak. And in the history books they tell that there was some kind of pogrom that the Cossacks were doing, and they were just, and the father ran in one direction, the mother ran in a different direction, and the rest of the family was in a totally different place. Everybody ran for their life, and witnesses later testified that the mother of Chacham Tzvi is allowed to remarry, because for sure her husband was dead, because they saw the way the Cossacks had like a hatchet. and the father's neck was all stretched out. They were just about to chop his neck off, and then the witnesses ran for their life. So they testified that the husband is badai dead. So the Rabbanan paskened that the wife is an almana, even though they didn't see the dead body, but it was mamish 2 seconds before he was about to be killed. So the mother refused to remarry for quite a while, until so 3/4 of a year went by. The father came back home alive. Father came back, he wasn't killed. The last second, the Cossacks had rahmanas on him. They decided not to kill him. So because of this unusual incident, that's why I think Rabbi Yankiv Emden has in one of his tshuvas that he was always very uncomfortable about being mishtatef in heter agunas, to write tshuvas to allow women to remarry, because you have an umden, a strong umden, and then the husband is dead. Unless you actually have the dead body, you can never tell for sure. There's a possibility that that the person is still alive. Anyway, so that's the parents. That was an asik with the parents. The Chacham Tzvi was an Ungarische. He was born near what we call now Budapest. His grandfather, I assume the mother's father, was a Kohen, and he wrote the Shari Ephraim, Rebbe Ephraim HaKohen, Shadis HaTshuva Sefer. And the grandfather lived in Budapest. When he got married, Chacham Tzvi got married, he also lived in Budapest, what we call now Budapest. And then there was some kind of a war, one of these wars. Every month in Danishtik there's a war. So there was a war, and a cannonball, I think, killed his wife and his baby daughter. And he was left all by himself. So because of the war, that's when he ran away to Sarajevo. So he was a bacher. He was single at the time. And he was an Ashkenazi. But because he had smicha when he was a teenager, he learned at Constantinople by the Sfardim. And they gave him the title Chacham. At a very young age, he was only 17 or 18. So, and he went with that name, Chacham Tzvi, Chacham Tzvi. So the Sfardim respected him very much. So they appointed him. He ran away to Sarajevo, not for a Rabbanis. He ran away to run away from the war that was going on in his area, in Hungary. So when he came to Sarajevo, they realized what a prominent Talmid Chacham he was. So they appointed him as the rabbi of the Sfardim Shekhila. But it didn't last for more than 3 years. His stomach, there was some kind of an asik. His son, Rabbi Yankiv Emden, always brags that his father was never mechaber ashirim, and he never took any money for a din Torah. And any money that they gave him, he would have them put the money in a pushkin. The money went to support the yeshiva and so on. So he didn't last too long in Sarajevo. So then when life was uncomfortable, so he went to Hamburg, and he married the rabbi's daughter. Married the daughter of the local rabbi, and they had a klois for him, a yeshiva. He gave shur, and young men came, teenagers came to learn by him from faraway cities. And he became a popular tamchach, popular magid shir. When his father-in-law passed away, so then they wanted to appoint him as the rabbi in the city. But there were other tzadim, there were others who felt that a different rabbi, somebody by the name of Ziskin Rottenberg, should be appointed rabbi. So that's why I mentioned before, they appointed Chacham Tzvi was a rabbi 6 months of the year, and the other one was a rabbi the other 6 months. Then they had this big machlokes, they shechted the chicken and didn't have a heart, and the Chacham Tzvi gave the modern psak that there is no such thing, it's impossible for an animal to live without a heart. Must be there was a heart, then it got lost. Can't be such a thing. And the other rabbi said, it doesn't say that in Yeridah. What are you telling me, science? Yeridah doesn't say a word like that. So if there's anything incomplete about the heart, the animal is a traitor. If the whole heart is missing, kalachem, then it's a traitor. So this apparently caused such a ruckus in the city, such a machlokes in Hamburg. So he decided to go back just to give the shir and the klois. No more rabbanis. Give sure he can't get into trouble. But then he didn't last too long in Hamburg. So then they accepted him as the rabbi in Amsterdam, the rabbi of the Ashkenazi community. There was a Swedish community, the Ashkenazi community. So then we mentioned the other day that there was the whole Asik, this is very famous, the whole Machlokes with Nechemia Chiyibon, that this this Nechemich Ivan was a Sfaradish rabbi in Sarajevo, and he was a big follower of Shabtai Tzvi, who was no longer alive at that time, and he wanted to sell a book that was written by one of the followers of Shabtai Tzvi, all on Kabbalah. And we mentioned the other day it had something about the Trinity, that the three, based on Kabbalah, the three aspects of Elokus. And so Chacham Tzvi at that time, together with Aram Chagiz, who was really from Eretz Yisrael, they were both in Amsterdam at the time. Aram Chagiz was the son of Mari Chagiz, who wrote his sefer, Shalosh Tshuvos Halachas Ketanos. They quoted once in a while. I think we rarely paskan like what it says there. So this Aram Chagiz was a mishulach to raise money for the yeshuv in Eretz Yisrael. He knew from his experience that anything that comes from Shabtai Tzvi is apikorsis. And the Chacham Tzvi had also had asokim with Shabtai Tzvi's followers years before. So they both declared that this book that Nechem Yechivon wanted to sell was all apikorsis, and they said you have to burn it and you can't be mechabed this Nechem Yechivon. And the local Sfaradish rabbi said, Faket. Rabbi Shlema Ailion, or something like that. We mentioned the other day that there was a Sfaradish rabbi, Al-Mosanino, who was a rabbi in Belgrade. Many rabbanim got involved in Europe in this machlokes, not only those who lived in Amsterdam, as then it's far away. So they took it as if it's a fight between Ashkenazim and Sfaradim. This Chacham Tzvi is an Ashkenazi, and that's why he's attacking this Nechem Yechivon. And we Sfaradim have to protect each other. So Al-Mosanino from Belgrade and Ailion, who was the Sfaradish rabbi of the Portuguese Kehillah in Amsterdam, they supported Nechem Yechivon. And they put Chacham Tzvi in Cheir. So there was a big machlokes in town, and he left. At that time he left. He was invited to become the rabbi in London. He had such a good reputation, but see, I was kind of out there, machlokes. Then in London also, he didn't last too long. Then he went back, I think, to Germany, to different places in Germany. Before I left New York, I was trying to do a little research on this machlokes. So to the best of my knowledge, the best research on this was done by Mrs. Bleich, by Judah Bleich's wife. Her name is Judith Bleich. His name is Judah, her name is Judith. So then I saw later, a week later, I saw Rabbi J.J. Schechter put out the Sefer Moruk Tzio on Arachayim, on the tour in the Beis Yosef on Arachayim, which was written by Rabbi Yankov Emden. So he has a long introduction where he has a lot of history. So he also writes, to the best of his knowledge, the best research paper on this machlokes about the Chacham Tzvi in general, and the Chacham Tzvi with this Nechem Yechivon. The best research was done by Mrs. Bleich, and she got her, she submitted it as a master's dissertation or a doctoral dissertation to Brno Rebbe Graduate School. So she quotes every stitch of information that was available. She wrote it, I think, in the 1950s. It's a long time ago, I'm not sure. But the Chacham Tzvi was a rabbi in many different communities, but he didn't last too long in any of them. But he was a prominent figure. That was in the late 1800s, early 1700s. He was one of the prominent figures in Sarajevo. He mentioned, when we first visited Belgrade, so I mentioned that the topic of the Erev in Belgrade is mentioned in the end of Gemara. Erev in the very end, after everything is all over, after the Riv, and after the Mordechai, and after the Tosefta, you have the commentary on the Tosefta by Rav David Pardo. So Rav David Pardo was a very big Talmud Chacham. It's interesting, Rabbi Akiva Eger has Mar Mekoyim, it's written, printed on the side of the Gemara. It's called Gilgyonei HaShas. So on Shabbos, on Daf Yud Beis, on the base, in the first parak in Shabbos, the Gemara makes a statement that when a person is davening the Yechidus, you should be careful not to daven in Aramaic, because when you daven b'tzibur, the prayers go directly to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When you daven b'yechidus, you need the angels to present your prayers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and ein malachei hashoras makirim b'loshon aramis. the angels don't understand Aramaic. So Tosfos is bothered with the kasha there. Every other language in the world they do understand except for Aramaic. How can that be? If you know all the other languages, you put everything together, and you can improvise, you can figure it out Aramaic. So in Shulchan Aruch, they quote the explanation of the Ravid that it doesn't mean so much Aramaic per se, it means not that they don't understand Aramaic. They feel that it's a bizoyan that a person should daven in the vernacular. We live in America and we speak English when we walk in the street, so we're going to daven in English. That's not the coveting. They told me that the boys who learned in the yeshiva in Hungary, when they spoke to the goyim in the street, they spoke in Hungarian. When they spoke Hungarian, but when they learned in the yeshiva, they wouldn't talk in Hungarian. That was a bizoyan ha-Torah. They would learn in Yiddish. They felt that you have to have some different language. So that's what they quote in the Shulchan Aruch. When you daven Michinus, you shouldn't daven in the vernacular, whatever the vernacular happens to be. Not that the Malachim don't understand Aramis, but they don't feel that it's proper that the person didn't even strain himself a little bit to daven in a more bekavadika language. So when Tosfos asks that kasha, how can it be that the Malachim don't understand Aramaic? So they word the kasha like this. The Malachim know, can read people's minds. They know what you're thinking. They know what you're thinking. What do you mean they don't understand Aramaic? But they know what you're thinking, so they know what you're talking about. So all the commentaries discuss over there, who says, where does it say anywhere in the Talmudic literature that the angels can read our minds, that they know what we're thinking? So Rabbi Kadeger over there writes, he gives you always marmakimis, cross references. So he tells you to look in the Sefer. This from David Pardo, his name is David. So all of his svarim had the name David in them. So this Rabbi David Pardo wrote a commentary on Mishnayos that's called Shoshanim LeDavid. If you look at the big Mishnayos, they regulate the first Svar Mishnayos, the Yochan Abayas. On the side of the Mishnayos, every 20 pages, they'll quote something from the Shin Lamed on the Shoshanim LeDavid. Then he wrote the commentary on, and he has on every single Mishnah. He has a comment on every single Mishnah. Whenever the Tosfos Yontem has a kasha on the Bar Tanura, he comes to answer the kasha. He always comes to defend the Bar Tanura. He has comments on Pikabala, very interesting comments he has. Then he has the commentary on Pirush Rashi Al HaTorah. I think it's called Maskela David. Then he has the Pirush on the Tosefta, that's called Chazdei David. By us, it's printed in the end of the Gemara, but the end of the Tosefta. So most of the Tosefta's they have printed on the bottom of the page, the commentary Chazdei David, but it was very much abridged. The original is much longer. They picked out some of the highlights from the Chazdei David they printed it. So Rabbi Kadeger on that Tosfos on Shabbos, the Tosfos says the Malachim can read our minds and know what we're thinking. How can it be that they don't understand the Aramaic? Rabbi Kadeger, there's a misprint in the Gilyan Ashas. It says, look in the Sefer Maskela David, but it gives you a different author. So that's apparently they couldn't read Rabbi Kadeger's handwriting. And what he really wrote was, Mahardaf, Marena Rab David Pardo. He was referring to this, and he quotes the Sefer, Maskela David, and he tells you where, which comment he has. He has on Pirush Rashi, on the Torah, practically on every single Rashi. Whenever there's any slight difficulty, he has a comment on the Rashi. It's unbelievable, Kemat on every Mishnah, he has Kemat on every Rashi, on the Torah. So this Rab David Pardo was born in Venice, and he was educated there. And his both parents died, and he and his sister were left. They had no money, so they had a very distant relative who was a wealthy person who was very kind to them, and he took care of them. And because the sister used to help, she used to cook and she used to clean this wealthy distant relative that they had. He writes all of this in one of his truvas, in several of his truvas. He put together the whole story, so he has this. So he says his sister, because the distant relative was kind to give them support, so the sister used to go and do the laundry after the fellow's wife died, because he had no children. So she took care of him, she made the food for him, and so on. So because the sister was so kind, so he supported both the brother and the sister for a long time. And he put in his will that Lachamev, Esam Shana, they should give a significant, after he dies, they should give a significant dowry to the significant portion of his Yerusha they should give to the sister when she's holding by getting married. So what happened was that the wealthy man died. Soon after the sister died, at a very young age, she never got married. She didn't have a chance to get married. So her brother thought that al pi hilchas Yerusha, he should be entitled to the schus that his sister had. He should get that amount of Yerusha that was promised to his sister for a dowry. And then the local Rabbanim were questioning whether that's correct or not. So they consulted some closer relatives that the man had. He had nephews. He had no children, but he had nephews who lived in a different village. So, not in Venice. They lived in a nearby village. So the local relatives felt that that's not right. Their uncle only meant to give it to the girl as a dowry. The girl never got married, so the girl never got the schus. So the brother, though his partner, has nothing to yarsh. So they went to yes, though Shaila, it was not in Torah, because the other party was lived in a different city. It wasn't in Torah. They asked the Shaila, and the local Rabbanim of Venice said that this Rav David Pardo is not entitled to anything. He thought that they were wrong. He writes in his Jewish, he still thinks that they were wrong, but because he had no parnasa, and he knew how to learn very nicely, and he couldn't get a job where he lived in Venice, so he traveled to Split. We're going to be visiting there. Prior to that, the Jews used to call these cities, a lot of these cities, the Jews had one name and the Goyim had a different name. So the Jews called it slightly different, Aspalita or something similar to Split. A lot of times there were cities in Europe where the Jews called it by one name and the Goyim had a totally different name. It wasn't even the same name with a slight corruption, like Dvinsk. Dor Samech and the Ragat Shavu lived in Dvinsk. And the Goyim used to call it Deneborg. Totally different name. Under different governments it had different names. So a lot of times the Jews stuck with the old name. They didn't go along with the change. So this Rabbi David Pardo needed a parnasa. He went to Split. He traveled to Split, and he became a Mlamed there. The Balabatim in Split didn't know to recognize that he's such a big Talmud Chacham, so they didn't make a Mlamed for little children. So they didn't make a big deal out of him. But the local rabbi recognized that he was quite a Talmud Chacham, and he encouraged the Balabatim that they have to be mechabed him. So after the local rabbi passed away a few years later, so the Balabatim appointed this Rabbi David Pardo as a dayan in the city. So he was a dayan for a while in the city Split, but then his fame spread. His people heard that there's a big Talmud Chacham, so then they invited him that he should come to Sarajevo to be the Rav. And he put out all of these svarim. They're really very unusually good svarim. There's a very famous Hasidic word, if I'm not mistaken, I think the Bnei Saskha has this in one of his Svarim, that there's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin that says when a Jewish person did some major Avera for which he deserves a death penalty, in theory we sometimes give the death penalty, it's very rare that he ever did it, but on the books there is such a din. So the Mishnah has an expression, what does the Shechina say? The Shechina is crying over the fact that this person is being put to death, and the Shechina will cry and say, "Kolani mi roshi, kolani mizroi." The Baal Shalom says, "Oi, my head hurts and my arms hurt. I feel terrible. Why this person is being put to death?" So the Bnei Yisoscha, I think, has this comment. He interprets the Mishnah based on a Gemara. There's an Agadah in Brachas that the Baal Shalom wears tefillin, just like we wear tefillin. The Baal Shalom wears tefillin. What it means? So the Mefarshim talk about. So what does it say in this tefillin? Just like in our tefillin, such Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, we write about the uniqueness of the Ribbono Shel Olam in our tefillin, Pesukim, Shema Ba'ayon, Shema Kadesh, Ba'ayon, Kedi Echos, on the tefillin of the Ribbono Shel Olam, also has different Pesukim, different parashiyos, Mikam Chesog Echad Ba'aretz, about the uniqueness of the favorite nation of the Am HaNivchar B'nei Yisrael. So the Ribbono Shel Olam is crying, his tefillin are a little shaky now. If the person is being put to death because he did such a serious avera, but Mechavim Mises Besdin, so he says, "Oy vey, my tefillin are questionable. Kalani Miroshi, Kalani Mizroi." that's famous from the Bnei Yisoschar. People say it over. So this, I was very surprised. I found this in the Shoshanim of David, the Rab David Parda wrote on Mishnah. He has it on that Mishnah in Sanhedrin. But then he has more. He has more in his commentary on Chumash and Rashi. Pirush Rashi Atar has, it's so pouring. He comments on every single Rashi. It's unbelievable. So he has the same comment. And then he says, after the Chet HaEgel, the Bnei Yisrael were going to be punished. So the tefillin of the Rabbanu Shalom were questionable. So then the Rabbanu Shalom said he's going to forgive the Jewish people. So then the Rabbanu Shalom, to demonstrate that he's forgiving, he showed Moshe Rabbeinu Kesher Shel Tefillin. So this I didn't understand what he wrote. This Rabbi David Pardi writes, he showed the Rabbanu Shalom showed him the Kesher Shel Tefillin. Kesher is on the outside. He didn't show him the Pnimius of the Tefillin, because in the Pnimius it was still weak. It was still shvach. I only showed him the kesher that superficially there was a mechilas avoinus, but the tefillin was still questionable. He has comments on everything, very fascinating. On the side of the big mishnayos, the brachas, they every so often the quote from this Shoshana of David on mishnayos. Some brachas they have the following comment. We're all familiar. The mishnayos and the Shulchan Aruch have discussions if you have two different foods on the table. As far as you're concerned, you like them all equally. So which one should you say the bracha over first? So it says if one is bari min mezaynus and another one is bari piyoyts, they say bari min mezaynus. But let's say they're going to have the spaghetti is on the table, but the spaghetti eat in the middle of the meal. They didn't wash for bread. The spaghetti is going to be served as a course in the meal. And they give a fruit cup in the beginning. So the fruit cup is either Adama or Haitz. So they really have to say Bari Minim Zayas to have a bit of spaghetti first and then eat the fruit cup. The normal Noik Shaboilam is eat the fruit cup as the first course, and then you go in order. You get to the spaghetti. That's going to be part of the main course. So the Shoshana of David is quoted on the side of the Mishnayos, who quotes from this Halachas Ketanas. That was all the same generation. Alok Stanis, but the Mari Chagiz, written by his son Maram Chagiz, he says, no, if there's a menu, and we know what the Seder Hadvar, what comes first, what comes second, so the whole Seder Kedimus doesn't apply. All the Kedimus that you talk about, that Awaits comes before Berkri Hadoman, Hadoman comes before Sha'akal, Zainus comes before everything, and so on. That's only if everything is in front of you and it's equally normal to eat first A or first B. But if there's a Seder Hadvarim, the normal Seder is first eat the fruit cup and then you get to the main course later, then you have to get filled the fish, and then you have the soup, and then you get to the main course, and the main course is going to have the spaghetti. So then you don't have to say Bari Minim Zayis first. Has very fascinating comments. The end of Yuma, the Mishnah has the din that Pikuach Nefesh is Deicha Kala Torah Kula. From day number one, when the Torah was given in Har Sinai, so the older people cannot fast on Yom Kippur, it'll be a sakona. So the Rabbanim had to give the din that Pikuach Nefesh is Deicha Yom Kippur, so some people have to eat on Yom Kippur. So the whole sugya of Pikuach Nefesh appears in the end of Yuma. So different Tanoim give different sources. But this din, how do you know Pikuach Nefesh is Deicha? Then an Amora Shmuel gives a different marker. And Rava makes a comment, I think Shmuel's pasuk is better than all the psukim of the Tanoim. So this Rav David Pardo has in his commentary on Mishnayos, in his Shoshana LeDavid, we usually assume, it's a question whether this assumption is accurate or not, we usually assume that Amoraim don't have the right to disagree with Tanoim. How can Rava give the Yashikoyach? Rava likes Shmuel's pasuk better than the others. Amoraim have no right to disagree with Tanoim. He has the same problem in the beginning of Chulin. The Gemara says, they quote Tanoim, how do you know that Shechita has to be Minat Tzabur? How do you know that you have to shecht an animal to properly shecht it to be allowed to eat? It shouldn't be an Avela. You have to shecht from the neck. Maybe you cut off the legs and you wait till it bleeds to death. The Tanoim give the Koris Ruchonish, and Amor gives a Pasuk as well. And the same thing in the end of the first parak in Chagiga, the Mishnah claims that the institution of HaTorah Nedarim, when you go to a Bezdin, Bezdin of three is Matan Neder, it's Halacha L'Moshe Misinai, it's Etet Nedarim Torchim Bo'avir, it means that it's transmitted orally from generation to generation. Ve'elahem al-Meshe Yismochu, there's no way to derive it by reading in between the lines in the Chumash. Usually the Torah Shabbat Peh is derived by reading in between the lines, a diuk, how can we switch from singular to plural, masculine to feminine, there's an extra word, there's a missing word, there's an extra letter, a missing phrase, or something like that. And over here, there's no makor at all. So the Tana in the Mishnah says that HaTorah Nedarim is Halacha L'Moshe Misinai, Ein Lehem Al-Meshe Yismochu, it's transmitted orally, Parchim Ba'avir, like the sound waves that are transmitted, float in the air, but it's not based on a person. And then you have Amoraim, who disagree with the Mishnah and with other Tanaim. They say, Yesh Lehem Al-Meshe Yismochu. So different Tanaim have the right to disagree with each other, that's okay. So there are Tanaim who say that at the Nedarim you can't derive it by reading it between the lines. But then one of the Amoraim gives a mocker. So how do the Amora have the right to disagree with all the Tanaim? So the Rav David Pardo in his commentary on the Mishnah raises all of these questions. He comes up with an answer that's really questionable. Others claim the same. He says, the only time the Amoraim have no right to disagree with Tanaim is when there's an Avkamina Halacha Maisa. But there's no difference in Halacha Maisa. It's just a question of where the din is derived from. So then Amoraim do have the right to disagree. So this is a famous statement that appears in the Maharshal in Sanhedrin. He says, with respect to a certain historical event, and the Gemara says that a certain Amora made two mistakes. So the Marshal on Sanhedrin on Daftan Day says he begs to differ with the Gemara. The Gemara didn't make any mistake at all. And he explains why it wasn't a mistake. And then he says, Reineni kecholik ala Gemara, I'm not disagreeing with the Gemara because it's no nafkemina halacha lemais. He's just interpreting the historical events. He thinks maybe the Amoraim didn't realize that there was a chunk of history involved. Bishop David Pat has a lot of fascinating interpretations. Soloveitchik had a very big chiddush, just like Aser Lohanes Menorah Mazeh B'loy Bracha, just like one is forbidden to eat food, to enjoy Hanasar Mazeh without saying a Birchas Hanenin in advance. So too, he had a deal from the Rambam, one is not permitted to perform a mitzvah without first saying the Birchas HaMitzvah. You need a matir, because when you perform a mitzvah, you're coming closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You can't just walk up to the White House and knock on the door and say, I'm here, you want to talk to the president. You have to have some preparation in advance. You have to have clearance. You have to have a heter. So the matir to perform the mitzvah is to recite the Birchas HaMitzvah in advance. Rav Soloveitchik said this based on different dinim that the Rambam has, different lashonos that the Rambam has. So there is a Tosefta, this David Pardo has a commentary on the Tosefta, the Chavdei David. There is a funny lashon of the Tosefta in Brachas, very awkward expression. Asa lahanis menalem hazeh b'loy bracha, ad she'atir aloy hamitzvahs. What kind of a lashon is that? You're not allowed to get hanoah from b'loy lamazeh, to eat food, ad she'atir aloy, until you matter the mitzvahs. What does that mean? So some say, you're not allowed to eat food without a bracha unless one is in the state of aninus. An einan is not allowed to perform any mitzvahs. So that's there's a machlekes in Rishonim whether the Einan recites a Birchas Hanenin or not. So the Pesach in Shulchan Aruch is the overwhelming majority of the Rishonim say the Einan is not allowed to say a Birchas Hanenin. So they interpret, some interpret it, that's what it means in the Tosefot. Until a person reaches a stage of Aninus and then he's not allowed to do mitzvah, so he's not allowed to say Achiatiru la mitzvahs. Others get different interpretations. So the Chasdei David interprets it along the lines like Rav Soloveitchik said. You're not allowed to eat food. You're not allowed to perform a mitzvah either until you recite the Birchas HaMitzvah. Just like Birchas HaNenen is Amatir, the Birchas HaMitzvah is also Amatir. The Taz writes Halacha L'maaseh like this. The Taz says, if a person has a suffix if he's obligated to perform a mitzvah. Let's say a person shook lulav and esrog, and he's not sure that the esrog was kosher. He has to shake lulav and esrog again, believe bracha, because suffix bracha is lahakel. That's how we pass it. Suffix bracha is lahakel in this case. But if the nature of the mitzvah is such that you're not really obligated to do it, let's say a person will put on a talis at night. So that's a machloikis, Taisus in the Rambam, whether there's a mitzvah to put tzitzis on a talis at night. The Gemara says, you're not mechuyev to put on tzitzis on pajamas. That's a ksus laila, that's night clothing. What if you wear a talis? A talis is, you don't wear dafke at night. It's not like pajamas. You wear a talis in the daytime also. According to Taisus, a bracha would be recited. According to the Rambam, the din is that Laila is part of the mitzvah. Taz writes in Milchus Slichas, Milchus Erev, Rosh Hashanah, that it's not really right to put on a talis or an abatalis at night, because it'll be a machlokes, but they say a bracha. So that's an issue to done in mitzvah. You're not mechuyev to put on an abatalis. If you're wearing a four-corner garment, then you're obligated to recite a bracha. If you don't wear a four-corner garment, you're not obligated, so don't get involved in the first place. If it's by Yom, and you'd be able to say a bracha, fine. But if it's by Laila, so since there's a machlekes, so you're going to put on the talis or the abakafis at night without saying a bracha. So according to Taisus, you're violating an issa. You're performing a mitzvah without having the matir. So the Taz assumes la halacha like that. And that Taz is quoted by the later poskim. They all assume like that. So there was also an interesting comment that has the David Amasecha Shabbos, when the Gemara has all the dinim, and there's one of the 24 prokim in Mishnayah Shabbos. So one of the prokim has all the dinim of Bris Milah. So they have the nusach that when you perform a Bris Milah, so you bless parents, Shabbizach Alach Nisa, the Torah Lechup Elamaisim Torah. So the Mephoshim all bothered. The Torah, you'd start educating the child at a young age. L'chupa, ben shmon esrei l'chupa. When he's 18, he should get married. Ma'aseh b'tovim is when he's bar mitzvah. So he really gets out of order. He should have said, the Torah l'ma'aseh b'tovim or l'chupa. So in Eastern Europe, they used to say, l'derech halotze, Torah l'chupa l'ma'aseh b'tovim, that the boy should grow up to be such a catch, such a bal kishven, that they should grab him up to marry their daughter before he's even bar mitzvah. Should be a Torah l'chupa before the ma'aseh. He should get married before he becomes bar mitzvah. What's pshat? That's a pshetl. What's the real pshat? So the Chasdei David points out, I never realized this. He says that the Baluita doesn't have that girsa. He says some just have the girsa of the Torah l'chupa. They don't have the ma'aseh. We do have the girsa. Ma'aseh Torah should really be included in Torah. Torah means learning Torah and observing Torah. So he said, we end off the Ma'aseh Torah just to end off the Chitoyv. But really, the bracha is really the Torah l'chupa, not so much the Ma'aseh Torah. There's another comment. There's a lot of very fascinating comments. But he's very long-winded. You have to have a lot of patience to sit and read. Mara comes to the conclusion that the Sifrei Torah before the days of Ezra HaSofer used to be written in a different script, not in what we call Ksav Ashuris. It was written in a script that the Gemara calls Ksav Ivri or Ksav Livono, like the alphabet in the Hammurabi code. They're totally different alphabets. So Rav David Pardo finds that hard to believe. How can it be? It says Aluchas Maisel Kim Haim of Amichta Michtavalakim Kharas Alaluchas. I mean, the Rebbe Shalom wrote in such a goyish alphabet, how can it be? He finds it hard to believe. The Tzuris Aosias of Savashuris contain within them so many Sodas HaKabbalah. How can it be that the Luchas had Amichta Michtavalakim who was engraved by Akadosh Baruch Hu in this type of an alphabet? So he has the suggestion. Rabbi Soloveitchik always used to like this suggestion. Others say it as well, but I saw Rabbi David Parda has it. He says, no, the Luchais and the Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote, that for sure was written in the Ksav Ashuris. But the Gemara says,
side to win. It's in the S.
The Luchais, the Mechtav Elokim, the Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote, that for sure was written in the Ksav Hashem. The Sefer Torah that the private people wrote, yeah, those were written in the Ksav Levi until the days of Ezra, when they changed it. So this David part that he was very unusual. It's hard to believe, that he didn't have a big yeshiva. He had quite a few outstanding talmidim. Later on, also wrote fantastic svarim. I'll mention some of them at some other time. He must have had a tremendous yeshiva. He must have learned an awful lot in Venezia. There was an awful lot of learning going on at that time. But these were all svardim, so the Ashkenazim hardly ever look in their svarim. But you see, Rabbi Kevager did look. Rabbi Kevager gives you in the Gilyon Hashas. He refers you on Shabbos Yud Beis Amba. He refers you to this sefer, Maskel David on Chumash and Rashi, by this Rabbi David Pardo. This Rabbi David Pardo was a mechutin of the Chido. The Chido was Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, and he was born in Eretz Yisrael, and he is a mishulach to raise money for the Yiddish Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael in Europe. So he traveled around to many different places, and he has a whole travelogue. He writes, he visited this city, met this rabbi. Wherever he would always look at the royal libraries, and would always, whenever he would find a Ksav Yad of the Meiri or some other Kisva Yad, whenever he found a Chiddush that he never heard of anywhere else, he would always copy it over, write it down in his Svarim. So he's known for that. He wrote many Svarim. So one of the many Svarim, I think they say he wrote as many Svarim as the number of years that he lived. I think there's 75 Svarim, 85 Svarim, something like that. And each Sefer is an entire Sefer. He has a whole encyclopedia on Kabbalah, all encyclopedia on Midrash HaTorah and Reshes Pemet, all encyclopedia on Halacha. It's a complete Svarim. Not Stami. He made 10 Svarim out of one. Each Sefer is a Sefer Shalom Bifnei Atzmo. So one of the many Svarim he wrote, he has a whole commentary on Maseches Horeis. So this, Rav David Pardo disagrees with him with respect. That before they became Mechutonim. They knew each other for 30 years before their children married each other. So this Rav David Pardo wrote a whole sefer disagreeing respectfully with many things that the Chidor wrote. But then the Chidor wrote a second sefer to defend himself from the kindness that his Mechutin have. And each one wrote about the other one before they became Mechutonim. Each one wrote with tremendous respect. When Rav David Pardo first put out his first sefer on the Mishnayos, the Shoshana Ledovit, the Shin Lamed that they quote on the side of the big Mishnayos. So he went to try to get Haskamas from the famous Talmid Chacham of the generation. That was the common practice. You don't print the Sefer unless you have Haskamas from Gedolim. So they looked through the Sefer and they saw that every so often he disagrees with some of the contemporary Rabbanim with such a Zam. He's disagreeing with them because he wrote to defend the Bartanura. They were writing kashas against. So he wrote that what they wrote is Dvar B'Teilim and the Bartanura is right. So some of the Rabbanim said they can't give a Haskama. How can he write on the contemporary Rabbanim that is Dvar B'Teilim? So they were going to ostracize him. So he said, no. He said, he didn't mean to attack them. He meant to defend the Bartanura. And all of his Svarim is very respectful, extremely respectful. I would never have written. A lot of things that he says are so obvious, obviously correct. He writes it with care. He doesn't want to insult someone who may say fakir, so he writes it with very cautiously, extremely cautious. Very big tamachach. He must have learned in a fantastic yeshiva in Venezia, and then he established a yeshiva. Some of the history books write that after he came to Sarajevo, then learning picked up much more in Sarajevo, but it was a major, he was in the 1700s, it was a major center of Liman HaTorah at that time.